Welcome to Technotopia, a podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Elliot Pepper, a novelist, entrepreneur, and VC. This is Technotopia. Technotopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people. Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com. Welcome back to Technotopia, a podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Elliot Pepper. He's a novelist, entrepreneur, maker. You wrote a book called Cumulus. It's your most recent book, and it's a story about economic inequality in San Francisco. So it's nonfiction.
Yeah, it would be sort of terrifying if it was fully nonfiction. Cumulus takes place in a near future is sort of in a San Francisco Bay Area ravaged by economic inequality and persistent surveillance. So it's sort of a dark view on what might happen here in the Bay Area.
Okay, so why don't you tell us a little bit about what the book is about, and then we can go into your view of the future, I guess.
Sure. So the book takes place in this near future setting, and one of the characters is the sort of major tech conglomerate that you could almost imagine if Apple bought Google, bought Microsoft, and then map that out 10 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. So we're living in this, you know, new world where many of the services that we might now read about as speculative have become real, right? So driverless cars, all that kind of thing. And at the same time, many of the social issues that our society has sort of always struggled with are still there. So, you know, I think it's one of those things that if you look at the history of Silicon Valley, part of the irony for me, having been born and raised in the Bay Area, is that the technologies that we are so successfully developing here, you know, often their promise is that they really sort of a rising tide lifts all boats, right? But that even in the Bay Area, there's still, you know, areas that have extraordinarily high crime, that are super racked by poverty that's systemic. So, you know, like most of the people growing up in those neighborhoods have a very tough time getting out. And so we have these sort of social challenges mm-hmm. that we've always wanted technology to solve for. But even as technology gets more advanced, and even as that advancement leads to economic prosperity, it doesn't necessarily sort of work for everyone. And so those are some of the themes that are really, really core in Cumulus about, you know, how, you know, we talk about software eating the world, right? And the nature of software eating the world and the nature of computing means that you can create scalable solutions to problems, which sounds all good, right? Like, why would you ever want to have to create individual solutions to problems if you could create one scalable solution that solved the problem all over the world? Mm-hmm. But the other side of the coin there is that people are the ones creating these scalable solutions. And so if you've created a scalable solution and it works everywhere, now you're the one who owns that solution, right? So now we've, by creating it in a scalable way, we've now reduced the amount of people who actually control how the solution works. And when we have something like software that really is growing into almost every aspect of our lives, right? Like, pretty much every new device has some kind of computer in it. And there are very good reasons why you would want to have it networked. Mm-hmm. But the more that happens, it makes it much easier for power, both economic and political, in our society to become sort of ever more centralized. And centralized power has often severe social ramifications if you look at human history.
Okay. All right. So let's unpack that. That was quite a rant.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. It's perfect. So I guess our question is, how do we avoid a form of centralized power? We could argue that something like a Bitcoin, even the internet, is decentralized to a degree that is acceptable to us as, techno-futurist users, right? It's decentralized, but it's not completely decentralized. We can't get on the internet without paying Time Warner a lot of money, at least in New York, right? So there's no... So the internet, for all its goods, it's basically a commodity at this point, which is being sold to us the same way you would sell bananas, I guess you could say. And the people who run the banana company are making all the money. What is it about the future that's going to allow us to avoid that? Can we ever avoid that?
Oh, I think we can. I just think it's going to be messy. So, like, here's a good example. So, many in Silicon Valley, for good reasons, when the internet was born, it was born mostly out of, either government research program, research programs funded by the federal government. And then after that, really grew because of hobbyists. Right, so people who really loved just sort of like the problem solving, sort of like DIY nature of figuring out what computers were, what could be done with them. And I mean, this is true mostly on the software front, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a little harder to be a hobbyist with a clean room, but you know, for software in particular, there's this cultural aesthetic within the software community that grew out of sort of self-reliance and being creative and being able to, you know, sort of diagnose and solve your own problems. And also the nature of working on software is that, you know, like, software is a language that interfaces with computer hardware. And so because you're using established heuristics that whoever wrote the language that you are working with set up, if you're smart enough, you can sort of always find the abstract conceptual solution to a problem you're facing because it was written by a human. So I think that there's culturally within the software community, and again, I think this is like hugely cool. There's this mentality of one, being able to sort of like, if you're smart enough, you can fix anything, right? Mm-hmm. And also that, like, you know, that why would oversight ever be necessary, right? Like, I'm doing it in my garage, right? Like, I mean, I'm just coding something. Yeah. I'm trying to help the world.
As a Bitcoin entrepreneur, as I am right now, that's a lot of fun, what you just said. Why is oversight necessary? Why is it necessary is a question. Absolutely. When is it enforced, and why is it enforced so ridiculously? And why, in some cases, like Ethereum, for example, do you deal with an enforcement that is so doctrinaire and so strong that you can basically destroy the entire system and still be beloved by the nerds who made it, which is another question, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that this is going to be one of the central questions that we wrestle with as a society over the next few decades, simply because I love that DIY culture, but that culture works well when you don't have huge potential ripple effects from something you're doing. Mm-hmm. Whereas right now, by its very nature, software is integrated into infrastructure, into pretty much everything we do and everything we make, right? And because of that, it starts having impacts for many other people who are not programmers, mm-hmm. right? And communities as a whole, not just individual people. And so I think that what we're going to see, and I think a lot of it is going to be messy and probably both sides are going to hate it, but is we're going to see a lot more politics in software, basically, right? Because now software is a victim of its own success. It's become so widespread that it literally impacts our entire society and how we work together and how our systems work and everything. And once you have something that has that much power and that much reach, by its very definition, politics will get involved, because politics is the messy business of us not murdering each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I think that if you're a software engineer, this is going to be definitely frustrating, because you're going to be dealing with people who know nothing about software and who are going to come to you with requests or demands that are going to piss you off, right? Because you're going to be like, "That's so dumb. We shouldn't make that. That's not how it works, right?"
Well, that's the regulation situation where you basically get an email, or no, you get a letter that says, "Oh, you guys are doing exactly the wrong thing right now. Sorry, we're about to arrest you," and you're like, "No, this is stupid."
Right. But like, on the other hand, right, it goes in both directions. Like if you're making software and it has a vulnerability you didn't realize that allows someone to like blow up BART or crash two subway trains into each other. Like, I mean, it may be awkward, but hell yeah, I want some oversight. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's fair for anybody to expect that they are outside the purview of living and contributing in a community. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that that is going to be a very messy area that both sides will hate for many years. But, you know, it'll be really interesting. Like, good big questions here are like data storage, for example. Right. Like right now, software is like the ultimate tool for surveillance of any kind. I don't just mean like NSA surveillance. I mean like, oh, you're building an app and like you want to see how your users are interacting with this or that button on your app. And so you're like A/B testing different versions. Mm-hmm. But all of that data is stored somewhere. And you know, that storage, the data itself has value, which is sort of like where a lot of internet companies are currently making money. And but there are also big externalities to having so much data about individual people stored in a searchable way, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can imagine a million downside scenarios. And I think that as we move forward and more of those downside scenarios inevitably come to pass, we're going to have reactionary legislation passed to sort of like throttle that down or set rules on how you can sell people's data or store people's data, which is obviously going to piss off every software company. Like, they don't want that. Mm-hmm. Right. But like, tough luck, basically. Or, you know, like that's they've become so important that now that is important as well.
Hmm. Okay. So it's abundantly clear why you're a novelist, because you speak in full chapters. All right, so let's take this back to the main concept of the whole operation. So what does the world look like in 20 years in your view? And it doesn't have to be, you don't even have to talk about from your writing, what does your world look like? What does the world that you exist in look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that number one, I have no fucking idea. Mm-hmm. I think that from what I've experienced, the most interesting thing about thinking about the future is not predicting it. It's just using it as a heuristic to think about the present. So as an example, venture capital investors, if they're good, make their money on betting on the right companies. Mm-hmm. And many people assume that that means that those venture capital investors are very good at predicting the future, at basically like cherry picking, you know, the best bets. And, I've worked in a number of startups. Before writing books, I worked in a number of startups. I worked at a VC firm. And my impression was somewhat different. My impression is that the best VCs, at least that I've interacted with personally, it's not that they have a, it's not like you could tap their brain and get a nice, you know, 20-year trend report with a McKinsey ribbon on it that is somehow more insightful than everyone else. It's not that at all. It's actually that they are highly tuned to thinking about the present and are also unusually aware of their own assumptions. So, for example, you know, like when you travel to a foreign country, one of the, it'll be fun. You're going to have a good adventure. But one of the more interesting things about it is that traveling to a foreign country suddenly allows you to look in the mirror and realize what assumptions you and your culture bring to the world and to your life, right? So, and it'll be in weird ways that you didn't expect, right? Like you might go into your first international jaunt and sort of think, oh, well, yeah, I mean, like the language is going to be different, like X, Y, and Z. But then you show up and it's like, oh, whoa, like I didn't even realize people showered this way, right? Like I didn't expect showers to be the difference. I expected food maybe to be different, right? So like that's sort of like a silly example, but I think it's a really important one because when you return home, you can carry that with you. You can carry that mental flexibility of having realized the box you live in, and we all do, right? Like it's important to have those rules.
So by your logic, the VC tries to stay out of that box as often as possible, right?
Either that, or at least be very aware of the
limitations of the box. Interesting.
Yeah, and I think the same is true for science fiction writers or futurists or anybody who cares about the future, right? And many people do. Like, you know, like if you want to make good decisions, if you're an entrepreneur and you want to make good decisions going forward, you probably also care about that. But I think that the important thing to think about is just that, like, yeah, like be aware of your own limitations. And I think that's where science fiction can be a really useful tool as well. To me, reading good science fiction is almost like international travel in the sense that it encourages me to challenge my own assumptions in a way that reading other genres of books, I love reading. I'm a novelist, so I read a lot of books of every category. But I think that speculative and science fiction in particular has this interesting like side effect of when you read a really good book, suddenly you'll come back to your own life and you might be like, wow, like what if it was really different? And I think that's also another important thing to realize.
But isn't
about
that, see, oh. So that's interesting. So isn't that, and we should you're good at this. Isn't the danger there that you treat it as entertainment? So you don't go into the movies and say, I'm going to build a Terminator. And you assume that you personally as a human being cannot build a Terminator in your backyard. It takes a very, very specific personality type, I guess, to say to yourself, oh, I saw a Terminator on the screen and I'm going to build a Terminator. And eventually you get something like Big Dog or whatever, right? So, And to the same degree, something like William Gibson's Neuromancer, that was I just pulled out my book. It was 1984 when that came out. I think even earlier.
I saw you post that picture.
Yeah. So that was my copy, and I read that back in high school. And the vision that he had for the future was. So the wild thing is, if you read that book now, it's basically like going on a trip to Japan. It's on the absolute surface, it's really calm and collected, and there are places that are really, really expensive to get into. But on the back end, it's just a riot. So he was very prescient when he wrote that. But what does it take? And you've been an entrepreneur, you've been a VC. What does it take to convert the idea? I saw a Terminator on a movie, or I read Neuromancer, and I want to make the internet. What does it take to do that, to flip that switch?
So I think that most people many people, when they think about flipping that switch, are looking for answers, right? Mm-hmm. So if they go to Terminator and they see Terminator and they're like, oh, sweet, that's what the future looks like, I'm going to build Terminator. Or same goes for William Gibson's work. Like, I read Neuromancer, I'm going to build the internet, right? Plus virtual reality, or, you know, like all these other things, right? I think that they're taking the wrong lesson from it. And that's because I think that when science fiction gets the future right, it's very accidental. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think I love William Gibson's work. He's one of my favorite authors. But I don't think what makes his work interesting is the answers or the specifics of the vision that he depicts. And it's great that in retrospect, he got a bunch right with Neuromancer, like, good on him. Like, mm-hmm. That's super fucking cool. But that's not why I like his books. Why I like his books is because they force me to ask questions of myself. So, like, I'm not walking out of the Terminator theater saying, I'm going to build Terminator. Mm-hmm. I'm walking out of the Terminator theater thinking something along the lines of, like, wow, like, what do computers mean, you know, when we weaponize them, right? Like, what is that? What happens in the world when that happens, right? So it sets off a stream of, like, what if questions about myself, about how I look at the world, about how, you know, where I think the world is going. And I think that is the most interesting part, because most people like William Gibson or top venture capital investors or other people whose professions involve thinking about the future, they have a lot of ideas about the future, mm-hmm. right? Like, I'm sure that if you did a podcast interview with William Gibson, he would probably have like hundreds of like cool
that's,
and interesting.
That's the
insight.
Funny thing about Bill. Let's just call him Bill, because I've sure. talked to him, but he's like your kind of befuddled uncle when you meet him. He's actually he doesn't have like a really deep futurist view on things. At least not that he shared in the interview that we did. And it seems that's historically how it is. It's like the smartest guys are really really smart when they sit in their room and woodshed, and then on the outside they basically just listen. That's the other side of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely think, and I think you'd honestly, like, I mean, I don't know, you've probably spoken to much more VCs than I have, but in my experience, like, so often when I speak to top VCs anyway, like, I feel like the better of an investor they are, and I think this has a corollary in the writing world, mm-hmm. like, the more humble they are about their own,
okay, I got you.
About their ability to predict. And I think that's the, you know, like, I honestly think that that to make the best investment or to make tell the best story or whatever involves much more of bringing, rather than trying to sort of trawl the internet or sort of scenario reporting or something like that, and like doing a bunch of projections to try to figure out, you know, what technologies are going to go where. I usually find that it's much more fruitful to like spend more time sitting with my own thoughts. So mm-hmm. literally literally sit outside without my phone, without a computer, and just think about what's going on in my life and how I'm interpreting it, and just letting yourself get deeper into those ideas. And I know that as a for creative work, I have a lot of trouble if I don't do that. Mm-hmm. Right. So like only by sort of giving yourself the space to really consider whatever question is haunting you, will you be able to make something that resonates with other people, whether that's an investment, a mm-hmm. novel, or anything else.
I feel like I feel like this should just be a writing podcast. We'll just call it writers talking about writing. Future. All right, yeah, so we have about 5 minutes left of this. This is the best thing about this is that it is freeform. So I want to make sure that everybody understands. So give me a couple good books that people should read that you really like.
Oh, yeah. Okay. This could be a dangerously long list. Yeah. Well, so
give me five that people should read during the summer.
Sure. So one of my favorite books that I was just blown away by this year is called Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. Mm-hmm. And Harari is this world history professor. Have you read the book by any chance?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So, Sapiens is like everything school should be without all the shitty parts. Mm-hmm. So, the author,
well, that's what most books should be, right?
Yeah, exactly. The difference is Yuval pulls it off.
Okay.
So, yeah. So it's this sort of, high-level history of the entire world, including evolutionary history, and it touches on so many different things. It weaves in so many ideas that I feel like every chapter gave me questions that applied to my own life, right? Like, and despite the fact, I mean, like, what I'm describing may sound dry or dense, but when I was reading it, it was like a page-turner. Mm-hmm. And I write page turners. Mm-hmm. So like, I was like, it was one of the best books I've read in a long time. So I absolutely loved it. I've also been really enjoying David Mitchell. So I only recently discovered him. Mm-hmm. He wrote Cloud Atlas.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, loads of other books. The first book of his I read was The Bone Clocks. Mm-hmm. And it's just incredible. He has this wide-ranging mind, and he weaves together these like really big and provoking ideas. But one of the most incredible things about his writing is that his characters feel like people within like two sentences. Hmm. Right? Which is just mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. for me as a creative writer, right? Like it's hard to create characters that don't feel like cardboard cutouts, and he is an absolute master. It's like in the first paragraph suddenly I feel like I know who this person is and I've met them before or I've seen them on the street. So I absolutely love his work. And then, you know, another one that readers might enjoy is, and I'll butcher the name, so I apologize in advance, but Paolo Bacigalupi.
Okay.
He wrote The Wind-Up Girl, which I think won a Hugo and Nebula Award. Mm-hmm. And his most recent book is called The Water Knife. And The Water Knife is about an American Southwest in a future, basically it's like the future according to the drought.
Okay.
So it's this super dark, like Quentin Tarantino story. And like a water knife is an assassin, a hired assassin whose job it is to essentially like kill people to get their water rights to like access, you know.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And it is like, I mean, it like when I say Quentin Tarantino, I'm not kidding. Like it is pretty graphic but like very interesting and very, like it's a very engaging story. And then finally, I'll give you one more. The Cartel by Don Winslow.
Okay.
It's almost like Game of Thrones if it played out in the Mexican drug cartels.
Okay.
So Don Winslow was a journalist for a long time. Mm-hmm. He spent like 10 years researching the Mexican drug war, and personally met and interviewed and knows like many of the journalists who have been kidnapped and killed. He's just done an enormous amount of work investigating the Mexican drug war, but The Cartel is a novel. Mm-hmm. So he weaves all of these real world geopolitical situations and things that have actually happened into a narrative that's sort of nail biting and really fascinating.
Have you read Savages?
I have not.
Read Savages. That's one of his best. So that's a stripped down drug story. But the whole thing is so specifically written. He takes out all the cliche. All right, so we've done a slightly different thing. We've allowed you to essentially create a chapter of a book called Eliot's Thoughts on the Future, and we have a good collection of books for people to read. Where can people find out more about you?
I'm pretty easy to find. I'm Eliot Pepper, my name.com. That's Eliot Pepper, mm-hmm. 1L, 1T, 1P in the middle. I have a severe lack of consonants.
Yeah, there's something going on there.
If you just search my name on Google, it'll pop up. I use Twitter pretty actively. I have a Facebook page, and it's easy to find.
And your
my
latest
books.
Book is called Cumulus.
My latest book is called Cumulus.
All right.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Eliot. Thanks for joining us on Technotopia.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
All right. This has been Technotopia. I'm John Big. We will see you next week.